Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. July last year, a little headline in the news, a new computer worm called Stuxnet had been discovered. Mysterious, powerful, maybe capable of doing big harm. Apparently, we had no idea. A new report by the New York Times says Stuxnet was the super sophisticated creation of the United States and Israel, that it was secretly inserted into Iran's innermost nuclear facilities and tore a big piece of them apart. This hour on Point, Stuxnet and the dawn of the era of cyber war. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the Stuxnet news? Do you believe it? Are you cheering? Mystified? What else may be in this Pandora's box? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is John Markoff, senior correspondent covering science and technology for the New York Times, co-author of last weekend's Big Times piece on Stuxnet. John Markoff, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What's the heart of what you brought us that was new? We had heard that there had very likely been a worm loose in Iran's nuclear facilities, that centrifuges had flown apart after somehow being tampered with. Where have you pushed with this big, deep piece? Where have you pushed our understanding?
Well, the piece of the puzzle that we added on the weekend was that the Israelis had created a replica, a model of Iran's uranium enrichment plant in Natanz, and that it was probably used to test the attack code that was later found to be at Natanz.
Natanz in Iran, of course, the sort of headquarters of their nuclear program, the Israeli model, I guess, of this, rebuilt at Dimona, the home of Israel's nuclear weapons and nuclear program.
That's right. And, you know, there are many, many unanswered questions yet. I mean, this is a puzzle within a puzzle, or many puzzles within a puzzle. But, for example, somehow the Israelis got hold of either the same centrifuges the Iranians were using that came out of AQ Khan's program in Pakistan, or they built replicas of those.
Mm-hmm. John, take us through this. I mean, there is, at the end of the day, still the issue here that there's a lot of faith in our taking this from you. There are unnamed sources here. It's not a super high level of evidence that you're offering, but you've put your full faith and credibility on the line here. Tell us the story, as the New York Times now understands it, of what happened here.
Well, I agree. I mean, the first version of this program actually emerged in the wild in June of 2009, a couple of computer security companies went back and they found that they'd seen copies of it then. But it then sort of went dark for a year, and in July of this year...
Last year,
a Belarus computer security company found the program in one of its clients' computers, and there was some attention to it, but it wasn't until a German researcher, industrial security control researcher Ralph Langner, took it apart and discovered that it was really quite precisely targeted at a particular kind of industrial control equipment in a particular configuration, that people began to see that it was a sort of precisely targeted weapon aimed at an industrial control facility in Iran that was used to enrich uranium.
And that the possibility of aiming it that way goes back, of all things, maybe not surprisingly for those in the know, but goes to Idaho, to the Idaho National Laboratory. What happened there?
Well, once again, that is an interesting coincidence, but it's by no means damning to Idaho. What we found is that in 2008, the Siemens company, the company that probably unknowingly supplied the industrial control equipment to the Natanz facility, approached the Idaho National Laboratory, which has responsibility for defensive activities on critical infrastructure work in the United States, mm-hmm. and they asked them to look at their equipment. And they did two things. There was a conference in Chicago where they discussed the control equipment. And then after that, there was a report created, which is not public.
This is the Siemens, the big German manufacturer. Their control equipment is used in industry all over the world, and it happens, apparently, it was used in Iran.
That's correct. That's correct. So we don't know if the IL information played a role, was used by the designers. It's just an interesting timing coincidence.
The way you write the story, you certainly suggest that when Siemens came just to check in with them, they may well have got hold of the blueprints, figured them out down to the bones, and used that, ultimately, to insert something into the Siemens equipment that went to Iran. So what, it arrived with a bug, a worm, Stuxnet inside?
So the Stuxnet, there are several versions, at least, of the Stuxnet program. And it appears that between 2009 and 2010, they added functionality. The Stuxnet program included the ability to exploit vulnerabilities in Windows software. These are called zero days. A zero day is a vulnerability that's not known to the outside world, mm-hmm. and so it can be used by an attacker to insert their code. There were at least four in Stuxnet, which was unusual, and many people took that to be a mark of its sophistication. There also were stolen sort of credentials, security credentials that were taken from Taiwan that were used to hide the program from the Iranians. It appeared to be a legitimate program. So it had a lot of features that were quite extraordinary. There's been a real debate in the computer security world about how sophisticated it actually was. I mean, some people have said that it's extraordinarily sophisticated. Some people have said that there are different components that looked like they were slapped together by different teams that had different degrees of sophistication. I particularly think that what is not solved is the question of insertion. How it got inside the Iranian facility is really a fascinating puzzle that nobody has a good answer to. I think my own guess is that we ran across Stuxnet because it broke out, not that it broke in. And that's just my sense from the way, you know, national-level intelligence agencies would perform this kind of attack. It's likely, I believe, that Stuxnet rode in on hardware that the Iranians purchased.
Mm-hmm.
That would make the most sense.
You know, whatever the path in, the outcome was, as you report, that something like 20%, nearly 1,000 of the centrifuges there apparently were sent off kilter by Stuxnet and tore themselves to pieces.
There seems to be a lot of evidence that the Iranians admitted they had that kind of a problem. The inspectors found that, you know, they had taken 984 machines offline at a certain point, and that number matched the attack structure of the Stuxnet code, so it was kind of a fingerprint.
And then there's this amazing kind of Ocean's 11 Hollywood element here. You report that apparently the Stuxnet software was designed to present to the Iranian monitors the image of everything working normally, even as, in fact, things were blowing apart down there.
Yeah, it had certain abilities to hide itself, and that was one of the most striking ones, is that if you were a system engineer watching the equipment, you would not know what the program was actually doing, because it was sending, it first monitored the process and basically created a profile of normal operation, and then projected that to the system engineers while it did its sort of evil stuff. But, you know, there's even a debate there. Stuxnet, for example, had very mild obfuscation qualities to it. You can really do a lot to hide the functionality mm-hmm. of a program, and Stuxnet was not well hidden. And to my mind, that raises all kinds of questions about its actual intent. It is possible that Stuxnet was meant to be discovered by the Iranians. You know, this could have been part of an information warfare operation that was not just about destroying the equipment. It might have had a much more complex, purpose.
It's a 3D chess here, but absolutely, you're suggesting at the end of the day that their program, and top American and Israeli officials now saying, appears to have been set back by years. There's a big issue we come back to here about evidence and faith. I mean, you have unnamed sources on this assertion of U.S. and Israel cooperation on this and all the impact. There's been some criticism, you know, people saying this is too big an assertion, a suggestion not to have tougher sourcing. You know, you've got here that Israeli officials grinned widely when asked about
its effects. I mean, how confident are you in what's being suggested in this story?
Well, I think I am confident in our sourcing that the Israelis have a model plant, and if they
a copy.
Do have that model
mm-hmm.
plant,
yeah.
you can work backwards to feel pretty confident that they were involved in some way.
And the U.S., that involvement, that cooperation?
You look around the world, and you look at motive and capability, and the number of countries gets really, really small. Somebody had to have the intelligence, had fairly precise intelligence about the nature of the equipment inside that plant, and I bet there's, you know, less than three or four countries in the world that had the capability of getting that.
Tearing up a fifth of a country's nuclear centrifuges is a big deal. It would have taken presumably a lot of missiles to do that if it was done the old-fashioned way. Is this cyber war, John?
I think this fits the term. You know, it's a PR term, if you will. It's not a precise term,
mm-hmm.
but clearly it looks like this was a piece of software that was intended to attack industrial infrastructure. That is more than hypothetical these days. But I also want to point out, you know, people have made a lot about Stuxnet being the first of. And you can go way back in history to an attack the U.S. does acknowledge, 1982. It's a precise analogy to Stuxnet. We inserted software into industrial control equipment that was produced by a Canadian company and purchased illegally by the Soviet Union at that time. And it went into a Trans-Siberian pipeline, and it created, at that time, one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in the world.
We've got history here, and we've got a future. John, I know I have to let you go here, and I'm sorry for that, but I appreciate your being with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Stuxnet worm and cyber war, if you like, with the U.S. and Israel reportedly going on cyber attack after Iran's nuclear program. We have a couple of great guests to dive on into this with us now. Joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Bruce Schneier, a widely followed expert on security and technology. He writes the Security Matters column for Wired magazine, blogs at Schneier on Security. He's co-author of the new book, Cryptography Engineering. Bruce Schneier, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Washington, D.C. is James Jim Lewis, Senior Fellow and Director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, expert on cybersecurity and cyber warfare. James Lewis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Bruce Schneier, first to the report itself. There's been a lot of talk about this for a while. People have said it looked like some kind of cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program. Now the Times says, yes, the U.S. and Israel have done it. Here's how we think it happened. Does it generally look believable to you, Bruce?
I think it does. We've been seeing more evidence since last summer when we first learned about Stuxnet. And in the beginning, it was a lot of rumors and innuendos and very, you know, things that didn't make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But the more information we get about Stuxnet, the more people talking to reporters off the record, the more it seems like that, yes, this was a targeted worm against the Iranian nuclear power program. Very well designed, very well implemented, and very successful.
Are we going to see more like this? Will we see an arms race in the cyber world as we saw an arms race in the, you name it, nuclear world?
You know, I think we will. I mean, in a sense, attacking the nuclear powers of a Middle Eastern nation isn't new. I mean, Israel did this to Syria in 2007 with airplanes, and now we're seeing it done in cyberspace. So in some ways, this is a more humane way of achieving the same policy goals. And I think we're going to see more things like this, you know, maybe not at the warfare side, more on the espionage side, but certainly things like this. Any kind of real war will include a cyberspace component simply because it's there and it's effective. And yes, I think we are going to see an arms race. I mean, one of the scary things about these cyber attacks is they don't come with a return address. When Israel attacked Syria in 2007, you can look at the planes and see where they came from. No one has admitted publicly to Stuxnet, so it's hard to know who to retaliate against. And that means things can escalate quickly and dangerously.
Mm. Jim Lewis, there's so much to look at here, but let me just come to you with the first question. Are you buying the story as the Times is telling it?
It's a good story, and we know that there's only four or five countries in the world that could have done something like this. Israel and the U.S. are two of them. So it's a good story.
The damage that has reportedly been done to the Iranian nuclear program, setting it back for some years, we're told. Does that sound credible to you?
Yeah, it's been a goal for a long time to get more time for the negotiating process. This is a normal part of non-proliferation strategy, is give us a little more time and maybe we can talk the crazies out of building a bomb. So, yeah, this is perfectly consistent.
And if this is the path we're on now, is this a one-time-only kind of attack, or is this the new way? Where does this go?
You know, the interesting part here is that there's probably 30 or 40 countries trying to develop weapons like this. As I say, there's only four or five at the top of the league, but this has been going on for at least 15 years. It's not new. What's new is that it's crept out into the public view, but Bruce was right. This will be part of warfare in the future, just like airplanes or tanks or missiles.
Bruce, you've said, you know, if somebody fires a bomb at you, it blows up. If somebody fires a worm at you, you can take it apart and learn from it. Is that the case here? Could Iran be reverse engineering Stuxnet right now in the same, you know, adjacent cellar room in Natanz?
I'm less worried about Iran and more worried about other countries that might want to build similar weapons and have the capability. But a lot of the reverse engineering we do in public, because all the security researchers, the security companies, Stuxnet affected hundreds of thousands of computers around the world. It didn't blow up their centrifuges, but it infected Windows computers everywhere. So antivirus companies want to understand it, want to be able to defend against it. And yes, we all learn from the malicious software that's out there. Criminals do it, and countries do it, because once you put it out, it's available to be reverse engineered. And I said that's very different than a missile. If I fire a missile at you, it blows up. If I fire a internet worm at you, you can capture it and you can look at it. And a lot of that happens in public. So yes, I think we're all going to learn from Stuxnet. It's a remarkable piece of work.
Bruce, can you explain for those of us not in the hacker realm why and how it would come to be if everything happened as we're told here? Why would the worm aimed at Iran's nuclear centrifuges underground in Natanz also have come to be out and around in the world giving other people problems? Why?
Because on the internet, aiming is hard. It's hard for me to aim something at you, especially if you are, as we believe the Iranian nuclear power plant was, behind an air gap, not connected to the internet. So that worm got into the Iranian nuclear power plant possibly through USB sticks, possibly through a laptop that was connected to the internet and then connected to the internal network. We don't really know. But somehow in that process, that worm started going around the world basically looking for its target. And if it infected your computer or my computer, you were not attached to a Siemens control system, it wouldn't do anything. And it didn't really promulgate very far. I mean, it was not designed like a criminal worm to promulgate around the world and do as much damage as possible. It was looking for its target. But, you know, John Markoff suggested that it didn't wander around looking, but it sort of got out because it couldn't get in fast enough. And we actually don't know. But the worm did travel the world, not doing any damage, but infecting computers.
Jim Lewis, but the other thing John was saying was that he's imagining that it rode in on hardware, maybe on this industrial control machinery, maybe Siemens machinery, that it didn't just get, you know, zipped off on the internet from somebody's desk in I don't know where, Langley or Tel Aviv, but rode in actual hardware.
Yeah, that's a pretty good strategy. And if you remember the December 2008 hack of CENTCOM's classified networks, it wrote it on hardware. It wrote it on a USB drive. So, you know, people think they're air-gapped, and it turns out that they're connected or somebody attaches their iPod to recharge it. It's a good strategy.
James, Markoff wasn't suggesting that the Siemens systems were infected before they were installed in Iran. What he suggested was that the Israelis used those systems, studied them, and then built a worm that infected them as they were already installed. So the hardware could have been a USB token. Mm-hmm. It could have been some small piece of hardware, not the actual target. The target was already in place when the plot was hatched.
The technology here is so endlessly fascinating. I want to bring one more voice into our conversation. James Lewis, Bruce Schneier, please stand by. Eric Chin joins us right now from Los Angeles. He's technical director of Symantec's Security Response Unit. Of course, they make all kinds of security software for all kinds of individuals and big companies and governments, no doubt, around the world. Eric Chin, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you look at worms and bugs and stuff out there all the time. Is Stuxnet in a class of its own or just one more critter?
Oh, it's definitely not just one more critter. It is indeed in a class of its own. And, you know, it's fundamentally changed our jobs a little bit. I mean, normally the threats that we're looking at are threats that are, you know, stealing online banking passwords or credit card numbers. And this is the first time we've seen something that's essentially trying to cause sabotage in the real world via malicious code.
Talk to us about the sophistication of this code.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about the attack in general, it's quite sophisticated. You're talking about attackers who had to have some sort of inside information, some sort of design information, to be able to understand the environment that they were targeting. It's written very specifically to that environment. If you believe that it's attacking these uranium centrifuges, then, you know, they had to have an understanding of things like the resonance frequency of those centrifuges, which means at what frequencies they would shatter and break apart. They had to have understanding of all the equipment that was in use. There's multiple pieces of equipment. We're not just talking about Windows machines here, but mm-hmm. we're talking about what's called PLCs and certain brands of PLCs. We're talking about these things called frequency converters. These are the things that control the speeds of the motors. And they had to know what specific brands of those, and they had to know all about what code was running on those. So in that sense, it was quite sophisticated.
In terms of interpreting it, and your people, I mean, you know, have you figured it all out, or is this just in a realm beyond what you've seen before and even reversing engineering or analyzing?
Yeah, I mean, definitely looking through the code itself was quite complex as well, and we learned a lot over the last few months in lots of areas that, you know, we, to be honest, weren't previously experienced in. It uses this whole new assembly language that's new to us and for malware code to use. We've never seen that before. It's called STL or SCL. It's the code that's running on these devices controlling these industrial control systems, and we've never seen malicious code written in that language before, so it's something entirely new that we had to learn.
What does it mean for the world then that Stuxnet is out there? It's apparently, you know, hit its target, but it's out there.
Yeah, you know, what's unfortunate about this threat is that it self-replicates. And what we mean by that is that basically it'll spread from machine to machine, and it doesn't matter if you're the target or not. You can get infected. So people will get this on their machine. Now, it won't actually probably cause any direct damage, but it's still going to be spreading, and it's probably spreading for quite some time. It does have a what's called a kill date, a time in which it checks to see what the current time is. And if it's basically past June 24th, 2012, it will not spread anymore. However, what we know from other threats that had kill dates is they continue to spread because people have misset times, for example, on their machines. In the broader perspective, you know, this is really something that people have been talking about in theory for a long time. People have been talking about attacks on these SCADA or industrial control systems for a long time, and this is really the practical realization of that. And so basically some attackers have demonstrated this isn't just theory anymore. It is possible, and it is possibly practical.
Eric Chin, please stand by in Los Angeles. We've got a lot of response to this. Here, Greg in Arkansas says, if this was a government action, it's about time we have precious few options for stopping Iran from becoming a nuclear power. Emily writes, from my perspective, this pretty much guarantees more ire from the Middle East. If the shoe were on the other foot, maybe one day it will be, and we were attacked like this, I can only imagine the passionate call to arms stance that our country would take. Let's get a call from New York, Long Island in New York, and Dave. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Tom, I think you're right. The real question I'd like to ask is, well, the technology is interesting. The far more serious moral and ethical questions about one government attacking the facilities of another government, doing damage and potential threats to life, is inexcusable unless there's a declaration of that to our head. And if America has sanctioned the attack on the Iranian site, then we are no better than Al-Qaeda because we're doing an attack without the formal formal steps being taken.
But let me ask you, Dave, if this manages to keep Iran from being nuclear armed, morally and ethically, is that not a good thing to keep the number of nuclear weapons down on this earth? Or if it's an alternative to a big, bombing barrage, is it not better than that?
If some other country used that excuse to attack America's nuclear facilities, then we would be up in arms against them and the rest of the world would condemn us. Right? There is never an excuse to violate the moral and ethics of going to war. And an attack on another country, no matter how you do it, is an act of war.
Dave, I appreciate your call. Jim Lewis, what about the moral, ethical implications of this way of going at this program in Iran?
You know, it's just another weapon, and we haven't quite figured out what the rules are surrounding it. The Iranians may not be the best case because they engage in covert activities all the time against Lebanon, against Israel, against the U.S. So, you know, it's not like they're innocents. They weren't victims here. And they haven't been willing to play ball when it comes to nuclear proliferation. They haven't been willing to talk. They have been very aggressive. And, you know, you're right. I mean, if the choices were an air attack, which we know the Israelis rehearsed, or this cyberworm, I think the cyberworm, you know, one of the nice things about cyberwar is that it's a little less damaging.
Still, is it war?
An act of war, this would probably qualify as one. That's one of the big debates. What is an act of war in cyberspace? And where people are coming out is in some way it has to involve the use of force. It has to involve something that's like destruction in the physical world. And this would qualify, but one thing to remember is the decision that something is an act of war isn't cut and dried. It's always a political decision. Who are the Iranians going to declare war against? It's a little late for them to say they're mad at Israel. You know, there's always this political element. So would this qualify as an act of war? And one of the few we've actually seen in cyber attacks, yes. But will the Iranians therefore go to war against anybody? I doubt it.
Well, or will we even know if there's some counter hit where it's come from? Tarviz in Larchmont, New York. Tarviz, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that this is a very grave development because this cyber attack can be used to attack water purification systems, our nuclear plants, our hospitals. I mean, this is a very dangerous thing, and we should not take it lightly. And the guy says this is a humanitarian development. He's absolutely wrong. You know, in Iraq, we did not allow them to have water purification systems. 500,000 children died because they did not have pure water, and they did not have saline solutions to hydrate themselves. I mean, this is Holocaust that we did against Iraq by sanctions against Iraq. Millions of people died, and the war in Iraq, and now this nonsense of cyber wars is going to make us less secure. Let's be sane. We are insane.
Tarviz, I appreciate your call. Eric Chen, is there any guarantee that this, I mean, you hear the upset about the prices that have been paid in Iraq, let's say, but could this come back to the United States as well? This kind of damage, Eric.
The Stuxnet worm, again, while it was maybe specifically targeted against some facility in Iran, the vulnerabilities exist. These types of vulnerabilities exist, and security issues exist in the U.S. critical infrastructure just as well. So, is it possible, is it feasible for someone to conduct an attack on a U.S. critical infrastructure facility? The answer to that is yes. I mean, again, people have been talking about it in theory for some time, and I think what Stuxnet has done is really brought that to the forefront and has allowed maybe some people to further the agenda of increasing security on these types of sites.
Bruce Schneier, are we ready for the era that we're entering here?
You know, I'm not sure we are. You know, there's a lot of talk about whether it's more humane or less than a bombing run. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could argue both directions. You know, compared to a bombing run, an internet worm doesn't cause any civilian casualties. Nobody died. Just the equipment.
But as Tarviz says, it could one day down the road be a hospital or water purification facilities or you name it.
And that could be the target of a bombing run. So, whether it's an internet worm or a bomb doesn't make a difference if a target. What makes a difference is how specific it is, how exact it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a matter of implementing policy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Stuxnet worm and cyber war, with the U.S. and Israel reportedly going on cyber attack after Iran's nuclear program, and reportedly with some very significant success, setting that program, it seems, back perhaps by some years. James Lewis is with us. He's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Bruce Schneier is here, expert on security and technology. He writes the Security Matters column for Wired Magazine, blogs at Schneier on Security. And from Symantec Security Response Unit in Los Angeles, Eric Chin is with us. He's been looking very closely with his team, studying the Stuxnet worm. Nina is calling from Boston. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have 2 points I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. The first is directed to those callers who think it's immoral or unethical for the U.S., you know, and Israel to have used this worm to stop Iran from making the nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a very perverse use of logic and morality to think that to put Iran on the same moral standard as the U.S. when it's clearly shown itself to be a dictatorial and horrible regime to its own people, and has openly declared that it wants the annihilation of the state of Israel.
So you would say bravo for going in and getting those centrifuges at Natanz, I guess.
Not just bravo, but I think that the rest of the world is secretly and quietly grateful and thankful that you know, Israel and the U.S. has done this.
I've certainly heard plenty of that response as well. You can hear it both ways. But let me ask you this. Even with that position, Nina, do you worry about the Pandora's box element here, that the same thing that hit Natanz, perhaps, and did this damage, could flow back toward the United States, could flow back toward Israel or anybody in the world?
I mean, of course, that's always a concern. But having used it doesn't mean that it wouldn't have been used if Israel and the U.S. hadn't used it. In other words, it wasn't really opening up the Pandora's box.
Yep.
I'm sure that they would have loved to have developed it on their own, and, you know.
though that could be true, and still it could be true that it was opening that box, I guess. Nina, I appreciate your call. There's a bravo. Let me get one more from Greenwich, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. What do you know, John?
Okay, Tom, you've opened a huge Pandora's box yourself, so I'd like to get to it quickly. If John Markoff is correct in assuming that a trial run for the Stuxnet was run in Dimona, which is the nuclear reactor in Israel,
yes,
in the desert, in the town of Dimona.
And that is what the Times is reporting.
Let's just remember that reactor was created in the 50s. It had the 20 tons of deuterium that was sold by the Norwegians to the Israelis with a proviso that if there were ever traces of tritium detected in that water, in the heavy water, that it could be returned to the state of Norway. Let's remember that when Eric Chin asks how all these details about power supplies and centrifuge frequencies were discovered, that would be the Nimmer brothers who sold this technology to the Iranians. They were obviously in league with the CIA. The reason the CIA destroyed all those documents is closely related to these questions.
The Nimmer brothers, you're talking about the Swiss group that was tied up with AQ Khan?
Correct. The Nimmer brothers, who were a private organization selling technology to the Iranians. Let's remember also that if the United States, akin to Dave's question, your initial question, if Dave is correct in that this has international legal implications, the United States, and I take it that would be the National Security Agency, who has the same talent sets and skill sets as the 8200 group in Israel, which is their internet and IT technical warfare.
Okay.
If the United States was indeed a participant in this, that the United States is assisting a non-proliferation treaty signatory, that would be Israel, in attacking an NPT signatory, that would be Iran, and also looking the other way as a non-NPT signatory, India, did what it did, and now the United States has a nuclear relationship with it. So,
John, methinks you're much better informed than I here. What are the implications of the thread that you're pulling through here?
Well, the implications are, of course, that we will get this back, that this will come back upon us, that if the United States did this, it is an international legal fiasco because we have broken law and attacked a state through the NPT, which is absolutely abominable because we are one of the drafters of the NPT. We ask treaty signatories to abide by its provisions. The IAEA, which is the police for the NPT, has been invited into Iran, has made some reports that are inconclusive, but for the Iranians to be charged with nuclear mayhem and nuclear threats while the Israelis, who have an illegal reactor, the Dimona reactor is an illegal reactor. Mr. Vanunu took pictures of the tritium facilities there. If the United States is aiding and abetting illegally an NPT non-signatory to attack another one, what does that say about our upholding international law?
John, stick with us for a second. James Lewis, can you respond? This is beyond my pay grade, but it's a very interesting question. What do you say?
Sure, and, you know, Tom, I have to say I didn't realize you had so many Iranians in your audience.
I'm not sure John is an Iranian,
probably.
In any case, he sounds like a serious person.
One thing people need to bear in mind is this happens more often than you might think, and so we know that at least a couple countries with these capabilities have done the reconnaissance on the U.S. power grid that will let them attack it should we get into a conflict. The U.S. is the victim of espionage on a routine basis carried out by two or three countries. WikiLeaks, the political stuff aimed at the U.S., not Iran. This is a new domain for conflict. This is a new kind of warfare, and all the advanced states have it. And to somehow say that we did something unique. On the question of doing something against Iran, first of all, not proven, right? U.S. is a likely suspect. Israel is a likely suspect. Sure, but, you know, as I say, I don't want to jump off the bridge and say the Times was right. It's a very plausible story. Second, it's hard to come to the Iranian defense. It's not like they're a country that has routinely observed international law. I mean, if you want to get into them supplying weapons to jihadi forces in Iraq to use against U.S. forces, if you want to get back to Khobar Towers, it's not like they're innocent victims. And sure, this is complicated. The issue for all of these
Do you know the law?
Though,
do you see a breach of law if indeed things have transpired as we're told here or not?
No, it's not a breach of law. It might be a breach of Iranian law, but it's not a breach of international law.
John in Greenwich, let me just ask you, it sounds as though you're quite firm in thinking it is a breach of law, but let me ask you this. At least two presidents, I believe, John, President George W. Bush and I think President Obama, have said the military option is on the table to go after a nuclear program in Iran. Now, if a full-fledged, you know, sort of bombers are in the air threat was on the table, how is that different from a Stuxnet attack, John?
Let's bring up one other thing, which is very, very important, Tom. In 1991, the National Security Agency laced printers with a virus. Those printers were then incorporated into the Iraqi air defense system. That was a much unknown, but well-known in the circles that I travel in. And that virus did indeed infect the Iraqi air defense system to a certain degree because the French had sold a fiber optic system to Iraq.
Okay, so what's wrong with that? I mean, there may be all kinds of legal problems, but nations go actually to war, I guess is what I'm saying. We ultimately went to war with Iraq.
Tom, I'm asking the absolutely fundamental question.
Yeah.
If we stand for international law, as the United States consistently says it does and berates others that do not,
yes,
we berate other countries that don't follow the IEA strictures,
yeah,
we're very concerned, we yell at Syria, why isn't there the same introspection when Israel, a non-NPT signatory, Bruce defends them, James defends them, but in reality, if we are going to uphold the law, then Mordecai Vanunu's testimony and his to the Australians and to the London Sunday Times is clear that Israel has broken the law many a time, and we are now allying ourselves with a lawbreaker.
John, let me pick it up once more right here, and I'll do it with Bruce Schneier. Bruce, what about the law in this case? And what about the law when it comes to cyber warfare, if we can call it that? Is it always going to be illegal?
Well, we don't know. I mean, one of the problems we have here is definitional. We don't know what a cyber war looks like, when it starts, when it ends, how it progresses, what is an act of cyber war.
But you heard the particulars that our caller John in Greenwich is laying on the table. Do those look like offenses of law to you? Do you wave those away if it's in the face of a nuclear weapons development program, which, of course, Iran says it's not? But if it is, do you just say, oh, never mind? What about his, technical adherence to the law call?
Well, I mean, I think he makes good points, and people who are political scientists need to figure this out, what the rules are. Is it different than a bombing run? Is it different than invading a country physically? How is it different? What do we do with non-state actors? I mean, one of the things we're going to have here is that these sorts of cyber weapons can be built by non-countries. So what does that look like when a terrorist organization or a political organization gets a hold of it? How do you strike back when you don't know who did it? You know, let's say Iran and the international community decides this is an act of war. Well, who did it? Who does Iran have a beef with legitimately? We don't know. You know, we were attacked July of 2009. We believe the attack came from North Korea, and some lawmakers were suggesting we strike back with weapons. But you do research, and the attack either came from North Korea, China, England, or Florida, which would have been awkward.
Yeah, we say that, but yet here it is in the New York Times page one. I mean, we're reading a story told, at least, that a lot of people are giving credence. You've looked at that, that when the South Korean and U.S. computers were hit, people assumed it was North Korea. I think North Korea is working like crazy on cyber warfare, if I understand correctly, Bruce.
North Korea is, China is, United States, UK, Israel, the other NATO countries. I think we're seeing the beginning of a cyber war arms race, that these weapons will proliferate. They might not be used, but because they can be come out of nowhere, because you don't know where they're coming from, a lot of countries are going to try to ride this wave. I think there's a lot of businesses seeing a lot of money to be made in cyber weapons. And we're going to see around the world a cyber weapons arms race.
Eric Chin in Los Angeles, let me come to you. We've got a lot of comments on Facebook here. Lisa says, this is way too scary. Mike writes, and we think that there isn't one or some worms, I guess, lurking in our programs because ... I mean, is it possible, Eric, that we've already got some big bad Stuxnet equivalent sitting, I don't know, in our energy dispersal system, in our utilities, in our water systems? Could they already be here, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have any evidence there's anything here, but both private organizations and governmental organizations have done what's called vulnerability assessments or pen tests and run through scenarios on if these types of systems could be infected, and indeed they can, and they've done, demonstrations to show that it is possible and that we do have critical infrastructure that is potentially at risk.
Let's get a call from Los Angeles, your backyard there. Saad is calling from L.A. Hi, Saad. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Could it be that the supposed damage or the delay in the system has been a little overblown? It's not really as serious as it is. And just a layman's question, I mean, can't you just reboot your system and use your backup software and restart, again from scratch?
Yeah, interesting question. I hear a response coming.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So there's a couple of things. If the attack did succeed, the purpose of the attack would have been to actually cause physical hardware damage, and we're talking to the actual centrifuges themselves. So imagine a big tube made out of aluminum, and then this tube essentially shatters into pieces and actually turns into very high-speed projectiles that would be flying across the hall, the room that they were in. It's not just
literally tearing themselves apart. 900 plus were told, while the video or whatever monitoring they had showed a nice peaceful scene down there, where the suggestion is.
That's right. So you would actually have physical damage. Secondly, even if they did replace those centrifuges themselves, Stuxnet did an additional thing, which it would attempt to infect essentially all of your backups unknowingly to you. So typically, these code developers who develop the code to run these industrial control systems will store them in, let's say a zip file, essentially a file that's on the computer. And Stuxnet would find those files and insert itself into those files. So as soon as you went to backups, you would get reinfected again unless you cleaned out all your backups. And that becomes a very difficult exercise. In addition to that, Stuxnet employed what's called a rootkit, which basically it hides itself. So at any given point in time, it's a bit difficult for you to, you know, with 100% certainty, ensure that your systems are clean. You might look at the system, it would appear clean, but really Stuxnet is hiding itself on that system.
Wow. Well, Jim Lewis, I want to come to you here. Roll the tape forward with us. There's clearly a lot of debate that's going to go on over this path, how it may be used, how it may already have been used. But what about, I don't know, doctrine and strategy and how we, the public, have any sense of what's going on when it's as subtle as this, as our thinking about conflict kept up with the technology?
That's really a crucial question. And one of the things to bear in mind, the new thing here, and it's been true for only a few years, is you can now use malware to cause physical damage. And Stuxnet is a public demonstration of that. And so you have a new weapon. And the questions that people are asking is, how do we decide when we'll use this weapon? What's the chain of command? Is it the president? Do you give it to the military? What do you do? It's clearly the president, but how does he authorize an attack? It's like another weapon. So do the rules we have now for normal weapons apply to it, or do we need new rules?
Does it get more or less worrisome as you look out into the future, Jim, as we become perhaps, maybe inevitably, more familiar with this realm? Do we get our hands around it, or does it become more difficult?
The worrisome part for me is that there are countries now that have this capability. They've looked at the U.S.'s infrastructure and figured out where the vulnerabilities are. But they're not going to start a war with us just because they wake up in a bad mood one day. The countries that have these capabilities are constrained by the potential U.S. response.
Maybe Russia, maybe China, that sort of country, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
When you get to the North Koreans, or when you get to the jihadis, when you get to Al-Qaeda, they are not going to be deterred. They are not going to feel that constraint. And so the question is not only how do we think about this in a military versus military context, but what do we do when the capabilities flow to these less constrainable actors?
Bruce, we just have 10 seconds, 15 here. Could it go there? Could jihadis do this from a cave in Afghanistan one day?
I mean, not yet, but certainly one day. I mean, this technology will only get easier, will only get more accessible. Our infrastructures are getting bigger, and they're always more connected to the internet. And this is a risk we have to worry about. I mean, I'm not going to lose sleep at night, but we definitely have to think about this. We have to prepare for it.
Some may well lose sleep. It's all on the table now, or getting there. Bruce Schneier in St. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today, Bruce.
Thank you.
James Lewis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Eric Chin at Symantec in L.A. Thanks, Eric. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook.